Nicotra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Nicotra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking on a really big one, an intellectually challenging, but I think absolutely essential book from the last century.
We are indeed. We're diving into Michel Foucault's The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, The Will to Knowledge.
And I think, you know, this is a deep dive that could fundamentally change how you view yourself, your identity, your sense of freedom, maybe even how you think about a visit to the doctor.
Absolutely. If you've ever felt that modern society kind of pressures you to constantly define yourself, explain who you are, well, this book offers a fascinating explanation for why that might be.
Okay, so let's get straight to the hook. The central claim Foucault makes that really turns everything we think we know upside down.
Right. He basically takes aim at this widely accepted belief, what he calls the repressive hypothesis.
That's the idea that sexuality was, you know, silenced, hushed up, especially back in the Victorian era.
Exactly. We all kind of grow up with this story, don't we? That the Victorians were incredibly prudish, and then the 20th century bravely came along and liberated sex. Foucault looks at the history and says, hang on, that's, well, it's a convenient story, but maybe not the accurate one.
And why does that matter today?
Well, if Foucault's right, then our whole modern obsession with sexual liberation, this constant drive to speak the truth about our inner desires, our identities, maybe that's not freedom at all. It might actually be a newer, maybe more subtle, more effective mechanism of social control. A different kind of power.
Wow. Okay. So that's really the mission for us today, isn't it? To understand how power might work, not just by saying no, but maybe by encouraging us, even compelling us to speak, to confess the truth about ourselves.
Precisely. And this book, Volume 1, is arguably the key to understanding how modern societies govern us often through knowledge, through categorization, maybe more than through outright prohibition.
So before we jump into the book itself, maybe we should talk a little about the author, Michel Foucault.
Yes, absolutely. Foucault, who lived from 1926 to 1984, was just a towering figure in 20th century French philosophy and history, hugely influential. He held the very prestigious chair of History of Systems of Thought at the Collège de France.
And he wasn't just recounting historical events, was he? His focus was different. We see it in his other major works like Madness and Civilization or Discipline and Punish.
Right. He was always investigating how the very ideas and categories we use to understand the world, things like madness, crime, illness, how these concepts themselves came into being. He looked at institutions, prisons, hospitals, asylums, and how they use specific forms of knowledge to exert power.
Power over bodies, power over minds.
Exactly. And his method, he called it genealogy. Think of it less like tracing a family tree and more like digging into the historical soil to find out how the idea of a family tree even became possible.
So when he turns to sexuality, he's not asking what is sex really or what's natural.
No, not at all. He's asking fundamentally different questions like, how did we in the West come to believe that our sexuality holds the deepest truth about who we are as individuals?
Or where did these categories we use all the time, like homosexual or heterosexual, actually come from? Were they always there?
Precisely. He argues they weren't always there. They were, in fact, invented, constructed at a particular point in history, mainly the 18th and 19th centuries.
And by showing their historical constructions, not eternal truths.
He challenges our deeply ingrained assumptions about identity being fixed or natural. It opens up space for critique.
Okay, so let's get into the book's core argument then, because as you said, it really reframes how we think about the history of sex.
It really does. Foucault argues, quite startlingly, that the history of sexuality since about the 17th century is not a story of increasing silence or repression.
It's the opposite.
Pretty much. He says it's marked by an explosion of discourse about sex. More talk, more analysis, more categorization, not less.
So that repressive hypothesis, the Victorians clamping down, us moderns bravely speaking out.
He sees that narrative as something we like to believe because it casts us as the heroes, the liberated ones. It makes our speaking out seem like a radical act against past silence.
But hang on, I mean, surely people did feel repressed. Didn't the Victorians themselves often talk about feeling constrained, about societal pressures regarding sex? Doesn't that feeling count?
Oh, it absolutely counts. Foucault doesn't deny the feeling or the discourse of repression, but he asks a different question about it. He asks, what was the function of constantly saying we are repressed?
Okay, no, was it?
He suggests that framing things in terms of repression actually served to position certain people, doctors, psychiatrists, clergy, social reformers, as the experts, the ones who held the key to understanding and maybe curing this repressed sexuality.
Ah, so the talk about repression was just another way to keep talking about sex and therefore to exercise a certain kind of authority or power over it.
Exactly. It becomes a way to manage it, analyze it, define it, which leads to his absolutely central insight. Power, especially modern power, is productive.
Productive, not just restrictive.
Right. It doesn't operate solely by saying no, by prohibiting. It actively creates things. It produces the categories, the types of knowledge, the forms of pleasure, even the identities that it then seeks to manage or control.
So it kind of shapes the landscape first and then manages what it shaped.
You could put it that way, yes. And the really big question Foucault grapples with throughout the book is, how did sex get transformed from something people did, an act among others, into the supposed key to our innermost identity, the very truth of our being?
The thing we feel we have to understand, confess, define ourselves by.
Precisely. And his answer is, it happened through this relentless production of discourse, of knowledge about sex.
Okay, let's dive into some specifics then. Part one, he calls it We Other Victorians. You mentioned the paradox.
Yes. Despite this image of Victorian silence, Foucault points to the 17th century onwards and finds this absolute proliferation of detailed talk about sex. It's everywhere once you look for it.
Or
in Catholic confession manuals, incredibly detailed about types of thoughts and acts, in new medical texts classifying sexual behaviors, in educational theories about childhood, in early criminology, it wasn't silence. It was a very specific kind of analytical chatter.
And this chatter, this analytical way of talking, creates what he calls scientia sexualis.
Yes, scientia sexualis, the Western science of sexuality. He contrasts this with what he calls ars erotica, or an art of eroticism, which he associates more with Eastern traditions.
What's the difference?
Well, ars erotica, as he describes it, is knowledge drawn from pleasure itself, focused on intensifying experience, a master-disciple transmission of secrets about pleasure. Scientia sexualis, on the other hand,
or a Western approach,
is obsessed with establishing objective truth, with classification, finding causes, linking sex to illness, pathology, normality, and abnormality. It's analytical, medicalized.
So one is about enhancing pleasure. The other is about diagnosing it.
In a nutshell, yes. Think about it. Ars erotica might offer techniques for pleasure. Scientia sexualis gives you a survey to determine if your pleasure falls within the normal range or indicates some underlying disorder.
And what drives this Western scientia sexualis? What's the engine?
Foucault argues it's the transformation, the secularization of confession, the Christian practice of confessing sins, especially sexual ones, doesn't disappear. It gets adapted and redeployed in secular contexts.
Like therapy.
Exactly. The psychoanalyst's couch is a prime example.
Yeah.
But also the doctor's examination room, the sociologist's survey, the HR department's questionnaire, even you could argue the way we talk about ourselves online.
So power starts operating through this constant compulsion to speak, to tell the truth about our desires, our habits, our identities.
Yes. We're endlessly incited to articulate ourselves, to put our inner lives into words, into categories. And every time we do that, we're participating in this confessional technology. We're producing knowledge about ourselves that can then be used to classify, manage, and potentially intervene.
Okay, that makes sense. Which takes us nicely into part three, the deployment of sexuality. What does he mean by deployment?
He uses the term dispositif in French, often translated as deployment or apparatus. It refers to the whole strategic network, the institutions, the architectural arrangements, the laws, the scientific statements, the moral propositions, all the bits and pieces that work together to constitute sexuality as a specific field of power and knowledge. It's the whole setup.
The structure built around this knowledge they were generating.
Exactly. And he argues this deployment didn't just happen vaguely. It operated through creating specific targets, what he calls four strategic unities. Basically, four new species of people that became objects of knowledge and management, particularly from the 18th and 19th centuries onward.
Okay, what are they?
Well, the first two he discusses are the hysterical woman and the masturbating child.
Right, the hysterical woman that links female identity very strongly to a kind of inherent sexual pathology, doesn't it?
Precisely. It placed women's bodies, their nerves, their emotions under intense medical scrutiny. It constructed femininity itself as potentially unstable, needing medical or psychiatric management.
And the masturbating child.
That framed childhood sexuality not as innocent or non-existent, but as a dangerous secret, a potential threat to the child's future health, and importantly, to the health and vigor of the population as a whole.
So this extended power right into the family, into parenting, into schools.
Absolutely. Through advice manuals, school surveillance, the fear of degeneracy. Power wasn't just in the king's court anymore. It was getting into the nursery, the classroom.
Okay, and the third unity, you said this one was crucial.
Yes, the perverse adult. This is a really key shift Foucault identifies. Before this period, certain acts might be condemned, like sodomy, for instance. It was a sin or a crime. But in the 19th century, particularly with the rise of psychiatry and sexology, the focus shifts from condemning acts to defining types of people. The homosexual, for example, emerges as a distinct species, a personality type, a case history.
Ah, so it's not just you committed this forbidden act, it's you are this type of person.
Exactly. It's a shift from the juridical judging acts to the medical psychiatric diagnosing identities. You get the invention of all these new classifications, the exhibitionist, the voyeur, the sadomasochist, the fetishist. These become identities, ways of being, not just things people occasionally do.
And that's a huge shift in terms of power, isn't it?
Massive. Because once you define someone by their inherent nature, their identity as a pervert, for instance, their entire existence, their past, their future, their very soul becomes an object of knowledge, scrutiny, and potential intervention. Power gets much deeper access than just punishing an occasional forbidden act.
It's managing the person, not just the behavior.
You've got it. It subjects the very core of their self-understanding to this power knowledge system.
Okay. Wow. So all of this, the explosion of discourse, the confession, the creation of these types, it leads up to his big concept in part four, right? Biopower?
Yes. The right of death and power over life, or biopower. Now, this can sound a bit abstract, but the core idea is actually quite elegant, I think.
Let's try to unpack it.
Okay. Foucault contrasts modern power with the older form of sovereign power, the power of the king, typically. What was the sovereign's ultimate right?
The right to kill, execute people.
Exactly. The right to take life or let live. Power manifested most clearly in the ability to end life. Think public executions. Modern power, biopower, Foucault argues, operates differently. Its focus shifts. It becomes a power focused on making live and letting die.
Making live. What does that mean?
It means fostering life, managing life, optimizing life. It's not primarily about the spectacle of death anymore. It's about the administration of life processes within a population.
So less about the executioner, more about public health statistics.
Precisely. Think about things like measuring birth rates, improving public hygiene, vaccination campaigns, managing demographics, ensuring the workforce is healthy. It's about the statistical management and optimization of the population as a biological entity.
Okay, I see the shift. But what does sexuality have to do with this big picture of managing populations?
Well, Foucault argues sexuality becomes the crucial hinge, the pivot point. It connects two major poles of this new biopower.
Which are?
On one hand, you have the discipline of the individual body, what he calls anatomopolitics, training bodies, making them docile and useful. Think schools, factories, prisons. On the other hand, you have the regulation of the collective population biopolitics. Managing birth rates, health, longevity, race.
And sex connects these two.
Yes, because sex is simultaneously about individual bodies and behaviors and about reproduction, lineage, the health and makeup of the population as a whole. So controlling and understanding sexuality becomes absolutely central to this modern project of managing life at both the individual and collective level.
So the state's intense interest in our sex lives, historically and maybe even now, isn't necessarily about old-fashioned morality.
Not primarily, according to Foucault. It's administrative. It's about managing the life of the population, its health, its numbers, its economic productivity, its overall biological fitness. That's the core of biopower.
Okay, that's a lot to take in. Let's try to zoom out and maybe crystallize the main takeaways. What are the absolute key messages you think listeners should hold on to from this?
Right. Good idea. I think the first and maybe the most paradigm shifting is the productive nature of power.
Yeah, that really sticks with you. This idea that power isn't just negative. It doesn't just stop you doing things.
Exactly. We tend to think of power as censorship, prohibition, saying no. Foucault insists modern power is often positive. It creates things. It produces the very categories of identity, the types of desires, the forms of knowledge that it then regulates.
And it makes us complicit, in a way, by encouraging us to discover and speak the truth about ourselves, but using categories power itself has provided.
That's the subtle trap, yes. Second key message, the historical construction of sexuality.
The idea that sexuality as this deep inner truth defining who we are isn't some timeless natural fact.
Correct. It's a specific historical invention emerging powerfully in the 18th and 19th centuries, realizing that the way we think about sex and identity is contingent. It could have been different. It wasn't inevitable. That's actually quite liberating, I think. It challenges those essentialist views.
Okay. And third?
The ongoing critique of the repressive hypothesis, that familiar story of Victorian silence followed by modern liberation. Foucault argues this narrative actually obscures how power really operates today.
How so?
Because if we think the main problem was silence and the solution is just talking more, we might miss the ways in which our very talking, our confessions, our self-definitions are being channeled and managed by new forms of power. Narratives of liberation can themselves be folded into systems of control.
Right. And the last key theme.
The deep, inseparable link between power and knowledge. Power knowledge. Knowledge, especially scientific knowledge about human beings, is never neutral or objective, in Foucault's view.
The very act of studying, classifying, defining
is an exercise of power. The scientia sexualis, the science of sexuality, by defining what's normal and abnormal, what's healthy and pathological, inherently justifies certain forms of intervention, management, and control. Knowledge produces power, and power relies on specific kinds of knowledge.
Foucault's writing is so dense, but also, as you read it, full of these incredibly sharp, memorable phrases.
Oh, absolutely. He was a master of the provocative statement, lines that really make you stop and think.
What are some that stand out for you from this book?
Well, the one that really sets up the whole project is, the question I would like to pose is not, why are we repressed? But rather, why do we say that we are repressed?
Shifting the focus from repression itself to the discourse about repression, asking about its function.
Exactly. It reframes the whole problem. Then there's this famous line about the nature of power. Power is everywhere, not because it embraces everything, but because it comes from everywhere.
Meaning it's not just held by the state or the ruling class?
No, it's relational. It emerges from the ground up in every interaction, every institution. The family, the school, the workplace, the doctor's office, it's a dynamic network, not a top-down imposition.
Which leads to that really challenging one about liberation.
Right. We must not imagine that by saying yes to sex, one says no to power. Simply affirming desire or speaking freely about it doesn't automatically mean you're resisting power.
Because that affirmation might be happening entirely within the categories and frameworks that power itself has set up.
Precisely. And finally, encapsulating that shift towards modern administration, sex was not something one simply judged. It was a thing one administered.
The move from sin or crime to management. Population statistics, public health, psychological profiles.
Exactly. From the moral or legal gaze to the managerial, biopolitical gaze.
So this is fascinating, but how can we, you know, apply these complex ideas in our actual lives today? What are the real life applications?
That's a crucial question, isn't it? I think Foucault gives us a powerful critical toolkit. For instance, think about personal identity and self-help culture.
Okay.
When we encounter therapeutic approaches or wellness trends that insist we must dig deep to discover our true sexual self, Foucault encourages us to be a bit skeptical.
Why?
Because that true self we're urged to find might just be a reflection of the categories and norms currently dominant. Maybe true freedom lies less in perfectly conforming to a predefined identity category and more in recognizing the historical contingency of those categories themselves and maybe playing with them.
Interesting. What about our digital life?
Oh, absolutely. Think about media and digital life. Social media, dating apps. Aren't they contemporary versions of Foucault's confessional technology?
How so?
Well, they constantly prompt us, encourage us, sometimes require us to articulate and define ourselves, our relationship status, our preferences, our orientations, our kinks, often in very specific drop-down menu ways.
We're constantly speaking our truth into the machine.
Exactly. And we should ask, what knowledge is being produced from all this compelled speech? And who is administering it? It's the algorithms, the advertisers, the platform owners. They're the new administrators of sexual discourse, using the truth we provide to categorize, target, and manage us.
That's quite chilling when you put it that way. And politically.
Politically, the concept of biopower is incredibly relevant for analyzing contemporary issues. Think about debates around public health crises, vaccine mandates, pandemic responses, or reproductive rights, immigration policies, even climate change responses.
How does biopower help there?
It helps us see how power often operates not through overt force, but through the statistical management and optimization of life itself. It's about managing risks, ensuring population health, defined in certain ways, promoting economic vigor, controlling borders based on perceived biological threats or benefits. It's governments focused on making live and letting die in calculated ways.
So it gives us a lens to see the often subtle ways that states, corporations, and other forces try to manage populations for specific ends.
Precisely. It encourages us to look beyond simple prohibition and see the administrative managerial aspects of power.
Okay, as we wrap up, what's one final thought or takeaway you'd want listeners to carry forward from this deep dive into Foucault?
For me, I think the most profoundly valuable and maybe ultimately hopeful insight is realizing just how much our deepest, most intimate sense of self, our understanding of our own desires and identity, is historically constructed.
It wasn't inevitable.
Exactly. It's not fixed by nature or biology in the way we often assume. And knowing that it was constructed means it's potentially open to transformation.
Mm-hmm.
We're not necessarily trapped within the categories we inherit. That realization itself can be incredibly liberating.
Yeah, it opens up possibilities. What about you?
I agree. And building on that, I think Foucault's lasting lesson is about resistance. If power is productive, if it shapes the very terms of our existence, then effective resistance can't just be about demanding more freedom within the existing categories.
It has to be more fundamental.
It has to involve critically examining the categories themselves, questioning the truths we're told about ourselves, understanding where they came from, and perhaps experimenting with different ways of being, different ways of understanding desire and pleasure outside of those pre-established boundaries. It's about questioning the game, not just playing it more freely.
A challenging but ultimately empowering perspective. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.